Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Podcast Like It. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phyllis Gove. And with us today is writer, producer of Game of Thrones, consulting producer on the forthcoming Lord of the Rings Amazon show, developing many secretive projects that you will love in the future. Brian Cogman, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Five Votes Down with me.
Thank you for having me. Kenny's mad at me, isn't he?
He's not mad at
me. He's mad at me. No, Kenny, you just. His absence is noted.
Is his absence on these TV miniseries are indicative of
we talked
having
about
four
TV
children.
Before. We talked about TV before, Kenny and me, and I feel like we had that little internet rift. I made an innocent joke about Cradle Will Rock and his reaction to it, and now, you know, I think
it's
now
true.
We have a feud.
I will say this. Kenny... As the listeners of our ER episode that you came on for many moons ago, feels like a different life when you came on for ER, might remember that Kenny said about five words in that episode because Kenny doesn't know ER. And that's not an indictment of him. But you and I talked at length about
he was
ER.
Like, I can't do that again. I can't sit listen to them.
And Kenny just, I mean, truthfully, I think that similarly to myself, we weren't like big TV people back in the 90s. I mean, I watched a handful of shows. I was, as you know, a diehard ER fan, but I was pretty sort of, you know, I didn't really dive into TV until I decided that I wanted to work in TV, and we had sort of this golden age of television. That, so obviously I love the West Wing, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But it's just interesting how these TV miniseries have worked out, where Kenny's got four kids, doesn't have the time to do these, and I've just really enjoyed doing the deep dives into these shows.
Oh yeah,
that were obviously incredibly important.
So he wasn't in the Sex and the City series.
He was not in the Sex and City series. The only TV miniseries that Kenny will most likely or will definitely be a part of is The Sopranos when we do that.
Oh, nice.
As our final TV miniseries for 99 sometime in 2022. So
oh, great.
All that being said,
fabulous.
West Wing, Brian Cogman, when did it come into your life? Did you watch it back in 99?
I did. I watched it as it aired. When it came out, because it was a pretty big deal. It was, you know, the American President had been a big hit,
yes,
and was beloved, and including by me. And then, of course, Sorkin. I mean, he sort of burst on the scene with A Few Good Men, and that was a cultural juggernaut. And for a long time, I mean, you know, ask me in middle school and high school, I probably would have said it was the greatest movie ever made. I watched
sure,
it.
Sure.
I mean, I wore the tape out. years later, you watch you, and it's still great. Don't get me wrong; I love A Few Good Men. But you know, years later, you watch it, and especially after decades of Sorkin, and you go, "Ah, okay, well, there's that thing," you know. yeah. But so, and then I guess Sports Night was out, but not. I don't think I was. In fact, I was not watching Sports Night, as most people weren't, as well regarded as that was.
Yeah,
I wasn't aware of it. I was deep in college, like acting school time. When this was in 99, when this was airing. But it was, I remember being kind of a, my memory of it is that when it was announced that he was doing it, everyone was sort of like, the first reaction was, what? Which is so funny. I remember one of the reactions, I don't remember if I read this or if someone, or if it was just a conversation I was having with someone, but someone actually said, I mean, how do you come up with storylines? Which is hilarious when you think about it, because there are plenty of storylines, but I just think the idea of an alternate reality president and an alternate reality kind of America going on that much. I mean, obviously there are fictional presidents in movies and the American president has come out, but sustaining that over a series, I think people thought, well, that's, how's that going to work? You know, well,
I think that it definitely
so I was very curious to watch it. I remember at the beginning.
Well, reading about the development of it, the show was not a foregone conclusion by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
I think that Warner Brothers and NBC didn't really think a show about the White House could work for the reasons that you just sort of that you just said. I want to sort of tap into something because I think that you are a theater person. You studied theater, you've written theater, all of that sort of stuff. And Sorkin is very theatrical. There's something I want to get your opinion on sort of the stylistic choices that he makes as a writer. I mean, a lot of people condemn him for those, and a lot of people love him for those things, right? I mean, talk to a lot of people about how this show was a bomb during the 2020 election and how calming and lovely it sounds. Smart people sounding very sort of, you know, musical in the way that they speak. There's something very lovely about that. And yet there's something very heightened about that that some people can't get on its wavelength. How do you think the show finds that balance?
Well, that's a great question because look, Aaron Sorkin has his own style. I mean, he's like, you know, David Mamet, where you hear it and you're like, oh, that's Aaron Sorkin. Now, I don't mind that as long as I know what I'm getting into and I'm like, I'm sort of calibrating my brain to, and look, I'm not an Aaron Sorkin worshiper. I love, and we'll probably get into this, I love certain eras of The West Wing. Yes. There are other series of his I can't stand. There are other of his I think are fine. There are movies of his I love. There are movies of his I don't. Yeah. There are times where his style, in my opinion, on a certain piece of material, it doesn't work. Like I could not jive, and I went and saw it on Broadway with The To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, I didn't see it. I wanted to see it, but I didn't.
Couldn't do it because it's like this, because it was Aaron Sorkin.
Right.
Speaking Atticus Finch speaking like Aaron Sorkin, and it's like danger, Will Robinson. Like it just doesn't. Well, the folksy hometown lawyer doesn't fucking talk like that. So my brain broke listening to it. But when it's sort of his universe, and when it works at its best, and certainly I think in the first two seasons of the 2.5 seasons of The West Wing, it's that's the peak in my view of Sorkin's thing. Yeah, I think it's also a marriage of his style with the world. And I think to your question before about how it was not a foregone conclusion and what I was talking about, where when I remember when it first came out, someone said, or I was reading somewhere like, well, the president's gonna have to declare war every week for there to be a storyline.
right.
You know what I mean? Because the idea of the show being about process. Mm-hmm. Like, and this episode's a perfect example.
Yes.
Of why this show immediately off the bat, you're like, oh no, this is going to be fine. Mm-hmm. It's so much of it is just about the nuts and bolts of governance that really I don't think had ever been explored in pop culture. Certainly not to this degree of detail. And his style, his sort of rat-a-tat-tat, hyperverbal, very witty, propulsive sort of style just works so well with this world and with which is why I really, as I said, I really love the first two seasons of The West Wing because they're just about process and about people doing a job. And then I think the show, when I always enjoyed the show and watched the whole thing, but it alas, even while Sorkin was still there, kind of succumbed to, oh, the president's daughter's gonna get kidnapped by terrorist, white supremacist or whatever, or you know what I mean? Like it had to go with melodrama in a way that those early episodes don't. And that's why they feel like a warm blanket right now.
Sure.
That's why you're just like, oh, it's the Clinton era where we didn't know how good we had it. It was kind of a comparatively boring time, and that's okay. And so you can have an hour out of the series just be about getting 5 votes to pass a bill, you know?
Well, there's two things that come to mind with what you're saying. The first is the show could be one thing pre-9/11 and had to be something different post-9/11.
100%.
Which is not the show's fault, obviously, but that's just the way that the world played out. The second thing that comes to mind too is, and we're going to talk about this a little later when we're going to do an ER episode after this, but the John Wells thing I think is worth unpacking for a second here, because I do think that I had Jessica Ellis on the other day, and she said something really astute. She said that the show, when it was under Sorkin's reign, was very much a show about ideas, right? It was about a debate of ideas, and that the stakes came from those emotional sort of components within the debates of whatever the issue is that they're debating on that specific day.
Absolutely.
When Wells takes over, it becomes about like exterior things, solving the Middle Eastern crisis, you know, whatever the case might
be. Well, yeah, breaking storylines. I mean, doing a more, and this isn't necessarily a knock on John Wells, who, as we all know,
obviously a very talented man.
Brian loves John Wells. But yes, starting with season 5, and season 5 is the one season of The West Wing I've only watched, I think, once, because it was the one where he took over. And
it's bumpy. Yeah.
It's really just like, whoa, this is strange. But it's that. You can feel them going, okay, we're going to break this like a traditional TV show, and storylines and big plots, and, you know, you're absolutely right, and Jessica's absolutely right. I never really thought about it this way. But yeah, the show in the early seasons, the process of the job and the ideas therein, they reflected and kind of refracted the emotional state of the characters, but they sort of they worked in a lovely kind of dance with each other, and what's great about it is, and I remember George R. Martin's always talked about his sort of governing principle when he was conceiving of Thrones, which on its face is nothing like The West Wing, but apart from a few walk and talks. but he always says, you know, politics is personal. And that seems like a very obvious statement. But I think what he means by that is you bring human beings bring their personal baggage and their personal history and their personal emotional state into the politics that they're engaging in. And one really does affect the other. And you have to sort of keep that dance going. And that's in the best episodes of The West Wing. This is one. And I think this is one of the very best episodes that we're talking about. Yeah. And my God, the fourth one. Talk about a show just arriving Ridiculous. Fully formed.
Yeah.
Holy shit. The fourth one. This episode really, I think, captures that where in a way that doesn't feel, and I think in the less successful episodes of the show, it feels kind of pat or a little like, oh, look at that. This means this. And, you know, he's really talking about himself here. The best episodes of The West Wing, you don't even really notice that. It's all, you know, it's all kind of beautifully woven together. But yeah, what an exciting, but it was exciting at the time. To circle back to your first question.
Yeah, it was fun
to watch at the time, especially being a young acting student, because it was a powerhouse cast of actors. This was a playwright who had become a screenwriter, and these were long dialogue-rich scenes, and the actors they brought in as day players and guest spot actors were all terrific theater character actors, you know. So it was really fun at the time watching it, and it was kind of interesting in terms of what was going on in the politics of the time. It was very clearly what Sorkin and everybody kind of wanted the Clintons to be.
Sure.
Like, it was the Clintons' politics and that wonderful progressive, yay, you know, up with people, we can change the world thing with a wonderful elder statesman granddad type who wouldn't know how to cheat on his wife even if you gave him an instruction book.
It is interesting to think about, you know, Clinton, as everyone knows, is impeached at the top of 1999.
Yeah.
And this show comes out, you know, in September. It very much is wish fulfillment, right? It's very much,
absolutely.
I mean, Sorkin's talked a lot about how the first couple seasons of this show were loosely based on the early days of the Clinton administration in terms of them sort of tripping over themselves and the inexperience and what have you of what was going on.
And the various archetypes of a few of the characters too.
Exactly. Yeah. George Stephanopoulos is notoriously a Sam Seaborn-esque sort of thing.
Right.
But it is really interesting to sort of this moment in television is interesting, which is that the West Wing is really the past and the Sopranos is really the future. And you're seeing this sort of fork in the road in 99 where very much, I mean, West Wing, as we spoke before we got on mic, wins a slew of Emmy Awards. I mean, basically everything it could win for 4 years, which is essentially, you know, the standard bearer that everyone's holding on to, being like, we've still got this.
Yeah.
Well, The Sopranos slowly chipping away. You know, you've got Six Feet Under that's coming out. You've got these shows, The Wire.
And this being a network show too. This being a network show that's very that's premium, if you will.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is showing sort of what is capable under the broadcast model. Like it really is, and I would argue still is sort of the bar with which everyone kind of holds broadcast television to. But I want to ask you a question because you brought up Thrones, and it's worth, I wanted to kind of unpack this with you a little bit, which is serialization.
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah.
This show does serialize things, but only when it's forced to.
Absolutely.
Like, Aaron Sorkin clearly doesn't really like serialization. He doesn't like being forced into a box of something that happened before.
No, totally.
There's very little, you know, his backstory for his characters doesn't really do a lot of that. The actors have their own stories that they bring to it for all intents and purposes. Now, in comparison to something like Thrones, which is the exact opposite, is a deeply, deeply serialized television show with more backstory than some might argue is necessary.
Oh, yeah. Certainly more than we included. I mean, you
exactly.
know. You, as
with the books.
It was the, right, yeah. correct. It was the polar opposite. I mean, Sorkin has, I mean, they've said he approached every episode with, I have no idea what this next one is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
just.
Which is nuts.
Which is insane.
It's absolutely nuts.
I mean, look, the man's a genius. So I don't want anyone to think I'm, you know, fucking Brian Cogan.
Of course. Yeah.
Ragging on Aaron Sorkin. Like he's incredible. and he wrote all of them. I mean, my understanding is that his staff, yeah, essentially functioned as researchers is a little too
think tank, if you will, of ideas.
Yeah, like they brought in, he had a lot of people, including Lawrence O'Donnell, who provides who's given a co-story credit for this episode.
Yeah,
a lot of people who were either playwrights or in some cases TV writers, but also political players that had never done television, and they generated storylines, story ideas, maybe even broke rough sort of arcs. And then he took those, disappeared, and came back often very much at the last second with these insane scripts.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that that scripts were written from time to time and given to him. He would essentially throw them away, but he needed something to work from.
I think when you see story by credits, is because there was a script that existed that he then, you know,
rewrote the whole thing.
Which, you know, is not. I mean, that happens to a degree in other shows too, but you know, he's just a singular artist, you know, and this isn't how you would do a TV show if you weren't him. And indeed, I don't know that he has nailed doing a TV show since, you know, quite frankly.
It's a fair assessment.
With as much success as this. And again, I think also because just this world is just so tailor-made for the kind of stuff he wants to say. You know, I don't know, but no, I love him. Believe me, I love him. Let's grant that now before we go on. But I forget why I said.
No, I think that there's something. We were talking about Game of Thrones and sort of the serialization element. Right. And I just sort of wanted
The serialized thing. Sorry. Yeah. Yes. So for instance, the multiple sclerosis subplot,
correct.
The episode we're watching, Martin Sheen has no idea the character is harboring a terrible secret that he has multiple sclerosis because Sorkin hadn't thought of it. He thought of it the episode he wrote it in. Correct. But it all plays out well. It all works. Yeah. Most of the time, once they've established continuity in the show, they, with a few exceptions where they mess up something, they basically stick to it. Yep. But yes, you're right. What's brilliant about the show, and goes to your point about network television, every episode, especially in these early seasons, is a beautifully contained three-act piece that has little storyline arcs like you would in a normal... But it kind of follows in that regard the old network television rules. Like, okay, we've got Sam's going to date Mallory McGarry for a five-episode arc, and we'll sign this actress to five episodes, and it'll play itself out in about five. And then if she's amazing, we'll bring her on as a... You know what I mean? And that's the rules of network TV, basically. Yep. So it sort of follows some of the standard rules, you know, to a degree.
In the early days, lot more. Yeah.
Certainly becomes more serialized towards the end, especially in the final two seasons, which are very successful. I think the most successful latter-day episodes are really that final season where they just are like, you know what, let's stop pretending to be the old West Wing and make it an election season and do what would happen. Like they wouldn't all still be on the staff. They'd have all been leaving and doing other things. No presidential staff stays together all 8 years. And so it's a drag when you're watching it because you're like, well, this isn't the West Wing, but I kind of get it because
if the show was to have any. If the show was to go past season 7, which they were hoping that season 7 was going to be successful enough that Jimmy Smits could be the president and move on with the show.
Right.
Something that I do think is interesting, you know, season 2 with the MS stuff does feel the most serialized in the sense of we start at one place, we end at another. I do get the impression that Sorkin does think like, I want this season to be about this and that I know where I want us to end. But everything in between, like I know that he talked about how with season 3, he knew that he wanted it to end with Bartlett okaying the assassination of Omar Sharif,
the fine actor.
Sharif is the name bastard. Of the character.
Yes, the Kumar. And Kumar is where the show kind of lost me.
They get into situations where they want to be a commentary on the world that is existing.
That's actually,
And it gets tricky. But I do think that this season you do sense, and there's one storyline in particular in this episode that feels a little bit like that, which we'll get into in this episode. But there is a little bit of network tinkering you can feel sometimes, where it's like, wouldn't it be nice if this character had something that was a little bit safe, or that our audience understood? You know what I mean? Like, no, yeah. I think that's...
In which case? I mean
in the John Spencer wife situation in this episode. Sure. It feels very... Jenny is basically not really a character. She kind of disappears from the show. It felt a little bit safe. It felt a little bit kind of NBC being like, there's so much going on in this show that we might not quote-unquote understand. Mm-hmm. We will understand a marriage that's on the rocks. Like, I think that there's sometimes stuff that feels like bearing walls a little bit in these early episodes until the show's obviously enormous success and all that.
That's interesting.
To Sorkin being able to kind of do whatever he wants.
Right.
But I also just feel like in these early episodes, even in the episode that comes out after this one, which is the crackpots and these women
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you have sort of, you've got Josh's backstory with his sister and all that kind of stuff, which is, again, works really well in terms of laying foundation for a better episode, which is Noelle coming in season two, when we see Josh really grappling with the death of his sister, the PTSD of the assassination attempt and all those sort of things.
Right.
So I do think that this show is unintentionally serialized and, to your point, is incredibly good at weaponizing the things that have come from the past, just not thinking about them as it's writing them.
Yeah, because the Spencer addiction subplot
is phenomenal.
Really flourishes later. Is it in season one or is it in season two?
It's in season two and three.
Yeah, see, if I picked a favorite season, it's probably two.
Yeah.
Because two is, I think that's when it's a hit and everyone's just firing on all cylinders. And
totally.
And as you say, the first season kinks have largely been worked out. And
correct. Mandy is no longer.
Oh, poor Mandy. We'll talk about her in a minute.
We will talk about her.
Poor Mandy.
But yeah, let me give a brief synopsis on this episode. Five votes down. Presidential Chief of Staff Leo McGarry needs five more House votes to pass a bill restricting the sale of automatic firearms, but the cost may be too high, especially if he has to go to the unpredictable Vice President Hoynes to help him put them over the top. The staff's annual financial disclosure statements prove to be thorny for Toby, whose innocent technology stock purchase last year proved to be wildly profitable. Which raises eyes due to his association with an expert in the field. In addition, Leo's long hours on the job cause an unforeseen crisis at home, and the president unintentionally mixes up the potent medications he receives for his ailing back. Five Votes Down aired on October 13th, 1999. Story by Lawrence O'Donnell and Patrick Cadell, teleplayed by Aaron Sorkin, directed by Michael Lehman, of all people, the director Heathers.
Michael Lehman. He directed it. Wow. Huh. I didn't notice that when I rewatched it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Michael Lehman's career is interesting in and of itself. But it is interesting that he directed this episode. He obviously did Heathers, Hudson Hawk, Truth About Cats and Dogs. A very interesting career.
Lehman directed that oneer. That's amazing. I just watching it. That
right?
Shlami.
Yeah.
I mean, Shlami was probably there, you know.
I'm sure, yes.
Essentially directing it, maybe.
I have a whole thing on the oneer, which I do want to talk about when we get into it.
Amazing.
But I do want to talk about the AA stuff for a second, because I do feel like it's a great piece of Leo. It leads to great stuff, but it also feels like a little bit of Sorkin working through some of his addictions.
Maybe a little bit, possibly.
I mean, he was going through a bunch of extracurricular activities during the West Wing. So I do think that some of this is him working through some of his stuff, which I do think is interesting. I also feel like the idea of people within the White House having addiction issues is an interesting thing. And by that, I mean, there's a really interesting interview that Sorkin gives where he said, there are AA meetings going on all around the world 24 hours a day. I guarantee you that within 5 miles of you, there's one happening right now. You don't need a ticket. Nobody checks your ID. There are a few exceptions. Commercial airline pilots have private AA meetings. So do judges and surgeons. So it occurred to me that somewhere deep in the basement of government late at night in Washington, D.C., an AA meeting for government officials so high profile that they couldn't possibly go to a regular meeting. And Sorkin is then asked, do you know if that assumption is correct? He says, I have no idea, but I'd be very surprised if they weren't. I have to believe that with 545 congressmen and senators, agency directors and White House staff, there's got to be a bunch of people who are receiving recovering alcoholics. It wouldn't shock me at all. What are your thoughts on this idea of an alcoholic not, or people drug dealing with recovering from things not being in positions of power? Like, I think that's absurd. I think that if you're a recovering alcoholic, you should be able to.
But it's certainly absurd. I think in 1999 it might have been
that's
more of a stigma. I think yes. Maybe we've evolved,
moved past it. Yeah.
So it makes total sense to me that the chief of staff of the White House would not, you know, want to necessarily.
Correct. Right.
Although the show does kind of do a funny thing where it treats some of these characters like did George Stephanopoulos ever have groupie girls outside of an event going, we love you, George? Like, I'm like, really? I don't think this is a thing. But that said,
so he does the same thing in Studio 60 with the showrunners of an SNL type show having people looking for their autographs.
But at least those are entertainers that if someone is coming to see SNL and they see Lorne Michaels, they want his autograph.
That's fair.
I can even see someone wanting George Stephanopoulos' autograph but literally three young women shouting, we love you, Josh. I'm just like, I don't really think that's a thing. But maybe I'm wrong. Underestimating the George of it all back in the day.
Not to disagree with you. Because I agree with you.
Oh, please.
Wholeheartedly.
Disagree with me.
I'm watching Friends right now.
Right.
And there's a Friends episode where obsessed with George Stephanopoulos.
No, he was a big deal.
And he's across the street and they're like,
that's true.
Get him. I was like, this is
or he was just, he had somebody at NBC just, you know.
That's also possible.
No, Stephanopoulos, he was a big deal. I remember when the War Room documentary came out and that was sort of his like, who's this? So maybe it's credible.
But I
guess
you.
My point is, I don't know that if David Axelrod back in the day walked into an AA meeting, if they'd be like, David Axelrod, maybe they would. If it's DC, DC is a small incestuous town. It's not unlike Hollywood in that regard. So
Jon Favreau's a Hawkeye. I mean, I get it.
Sure. So anyway, what I like about it, I think the main function of it, again, is the main function of it in the storyline, apart from the fact that it's a great Leo showcase episode. And it's one of those wonderful episodes that kind of focuses on one character a little more than the others, is dealing with his or her personal life along with the job and how they sort of affect each other. But so I like all of that. But then it really exists to sort of put you off kilter about Hoynes.
Yeah.
Who is a really great character. I kind of wish there'd been more of Hoynes because Matheson's terrific.
He is.
And the way his character ended up was kind of a obvious sort of.
Well, they really use Hoynes.
In season four, they make him just a total douchebag and give him a scandal so he can get out of office so John Goodman can be president.
Correct.
That weird, which is too bad because Hoynes is actually, up in the first two or three seasons, a really interesting foil.
He does come back in the John Wells seasons in weird ways. It's a very strange thing. Hoynes, first of all, it's a testament to Matheson, who I think is phenomenal, that the character, it's pretty clear that the character from a writer's perspective is kind of a skeleton key, which is they twist him and turn him however they feel necessary to get where
he's a foil.
Need to go.
He's a foil. Yes. Yes.
So it's a testament to Matheson that even with all the crazy shit they put Hoynes through over the seven seasons of the show, he still comes out on the other side of it feeling like a three-dimensional character that doesn't feel too all over the map. But to your point,
agreed.
He definitely feels in these early seasons much more of a sort of a foil, as you said, but much more sort of rock solid character who is very steadfast in his beliefs and believes that someday will be the president himself.
Yeah, believes he should have been, and he was done dirty, and done dirty by the guy he is supposed to serve, which is very true to life in a lot of the situations, which I really find interesting. But with the AA of it all, what's beautiful about that scene is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Certainly when you're watching it the first time through, he seems very sincere and real, like he's an addict who recognizes another addict and wants to help. And I think to a degree that is true, mm-hmm. but he's also putting Leo at ease so he can agree to what Leo wants and then essentially stab the administration in the back, which is what Leo knows he's going to do anyway.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think isn't really angry with him because A, he got beat, and B, he showed him this sort of humanity. So it's a lovely construction in that regard, because you don't quite know how you feel about Hoynes at the end, which is very much the point. It's actually why, jumping ahead, I don't like that last scene with him and Josh. It's not necessary.
I agree.
We absolutely
it actually undercuts Hoynes.
It undercuts him. It's like, and also, I love Bradley Whitford. I love Josh Lyman. I find Josh, he's rather insufferable in this episode, which I guess is the point. He's supposed to be taken down a peg. Which, again, I would have preferred, and Whitford's great in that moment where he's watching the news and he just can't take it and he walks out. I would have loved that to have been Josh's last scene.
I agree.
Instead of being like, Josh gets he was beat and he's going to get him next time. And I'm like, okay. Because, you know, just if you're going to do an episode where it's hubris and we deserved it, like, end it with that. You know
what I mean? Well, the thing that I love, by the way. We known... And we don't find this out until later, but had we known that Josh worked for Hoynes...
Right, which don't know when they're shooting the scene.
Exactly.
Sorkin hadn't made it up. And that's another flaw, maybe, because you're absolutely right. I was watching it, remembering what I remember about the show, and being like, oh, is this the scene where they have it out about their past? And then when they didn't, I was like, right, they don't have it out, because neither actor nor does the writer know that they have a past.
Correct.
That's old school TV. Like this whole you have to have the entire series worked out before you pitch it thing is very recent.
I agree.
It used to be that you just you crank out 24 episodes and you just you concentrated on that one and then you built on it. So this isn't really a criticism because that they hadn't In fact, the scene was probably so. I will say, even though I don't love the scene, their chemistry is so good, it probably sparked the idea that, ooh, wait a minute.
Yep.
They have a history. So, you know. Anyway, we jumped ahead.
Yeah, I want to dive into the episode itself and start with a standout in the series, which is this oneer.
My God.
So Bartlett's giving a speech.
Five times.
It's beautiful.
I cry.
I have some production notes on it, but I just wanted to give some context. Bartlett's giving a speech. Josh and Leo find out that they're 5 votes short on passing a new gun bill. And we follow Bartlett and the whole staff through the bowels of the building, through the kitchen and what have you, and then out to the motorcade.
Right. It's like a hotel or something.
Yeah, it's a hotel. Yeah. So Thomas DeRuth, who was the DP of the show, gave a really interesting thing here where he said, the longest and most complicated Steadicam shot so far on the West Wing was 4 minutes long, took place at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. The operator was the ambassador. The operator was Dave Committees. DeRuth recalls, it started out on the dance floor. We went into the lobby through the top floor kitchen area, down two flights of stairs into the bowels of the kitchen, through the cavernous kitchen where food was being prepared for a banquet. We worked our way through that area, went down another flight of stairs to where the laundry facilities are, then proceeded into the catacombs all the way through the base of the hotel into the parking lot where we ended up in the motorcade. The shot involved more than 500 extras, nearly all of the major cast members, and it was all done in one seamless Steadicam shot. Each take required one magazine of film, and the actors had to pass off dialogue from one another. Film, people. It required quite a bit of orchestration. It was about a 5-page scene, took us half the night to shoot. they did 13 takes of it. Martin Sheen.
I mean,
Sheen,
just that it only took half the night to shoot. I'm just like,
it doesn't make any sense that they were able to do it. I mean, truly, they would never do this today. You'd never eat up that much time of your schedule on one shot. Like, you just wouldn't do
well,
it.
Well, we have, but
you did.
But I don't know that we did one. I don't know that we ever did one this complicated. And we certainly never did one that involved dialogue of this.
Right.
Any
well,
shot
this is the equivalent of like
was
of the Goodfellas shot in the coma. It's. So I don't know if you noticed this. I know you watched the scene a bunch of times. I watched it a couple times too. Martin Sheen fucks up.
He fucks up and Dulé Hill saves him.
And saves his ass. And it's amazing because unless you are looking for it, you'd never notice it, obviously.
No, at least noticed it because I read somewhere that it happened.
Right. Basically, he delivers a line to Toby about being a pain in the ass. And if you listen carefully, he gives a groaning noise.
Yep.
Charlie Dulé Hill jumps in with Mr. President. Sheen replies, "Oh yes, Charlie. By the way, did the first lady call?"
He groans because he can't find his next line.
He can't find his line.
He knows they're at the end of the take, and they've done it 11 times.
Who knows how many times?
Dulé Hill is a hero. And then I imagine they probably did it 2 or 3 more times to see if they could get it perfect. And then finally, they said, "You know what? Let's go back and look at take 10." You know what? It's good enough.
Great. It's great.
It's a wrap. That's undoubtedly what happened. It's a beautiful scene.
It is. There's a couple things I want to unpack within the actual dialogue of the scene. The first is that the majority of the scene is about Toby being precious about his speech, which is very Sorkin because Bartlett went off book.
And laying the groundwork, though, for me, one of the best emotional arcs of the entire series, which is the president and Toby's dynamic, which really flourishes in season 3. And then don't even get me started to what they do to Toby in the later seasons. But it's, again, it's there. And here it's lighthearted and fun. Mm-hmm. But again, the writers and the actor is, okay, this is working. This is cooking.
Yeah.
In later episodes, how do we deepen this a bit, you know?
Even in the next episode, you've got Toby finding out that he wasn't Bartlett's first choice.
Oh, is that the next one? That's a great scene.
It's in the next one. And they have a great scene together where Bartlett says to him, "I'd be nowhere without you." I can't believe I even considered not having you there. The dynamic that I love so much that you're speaking of is two men from very different upbringings, very different people, and Bartlett resenting and knowing that he needs Toby to keep his feet to the flame.
Yeah.
Like and when Toby gets in his head, hating the fact that he's got somebody in his head, it's really amazing. I mean, I think about Tony Soprano and how much he hates Melfi at times, getting in his head.
That's interesting.
They have a similar dynamic of these very powerful men who just can't stand the fact that they can't do it on their own.
Yeah.
There's something very interesting in that.
Absolutely.
There's a wonderful moment, a lighthearted moment, where Bartlett walks by a couple that are making out, cute. And he says, "Hey there, fella, she deserves a nice room and some supper."
It's great.
It's great. That's the stuff that it's the juice of this show that I just absolutely adore.
Yeah, no, the whole thing, I mean, it's everything. It's like concentrated everything Aaron Sorkin does best is forget about the technical virtuosity of the shot, God. But just the little scenelets and how they transition into each other. And, you know, Allison Janney, God bless her, is like, "Do I have an unusually large neck?" What? this great stuff. Yeah. But then, you know, God, poor Mandy. Every scene poor Moira Kelly ever had on the show after the pilot was, "Mandy, you did something bad. You fucked up. You don't belong here." Every scene is her just being. It's like they decided, and it's not her fault. Moira Kelly's great. And I've often heard it say, "Well, she never really gelled with the ensemble." I think she could have gelled with the ensemble. It's like they decided immediately, I don't like this character I just created, and I'm going to destroy her. almost immediately. I think it's two things.
I totally agree with you. I think it's two things. The first is that it becomes clear very early on that she's an antagonist to the administration. She's the one who's always saying you can't do things and you can't be altruistic and you can't be so naive, which
that's no fun.
Sorkin hates.
Yeah.
A character that tells him he can't be, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then on top of it, Donna, which is that she hits the ground running.
Well,
and Janelle is so fucking good that the banter that was going to exist between Josh and Mandy essentially just becomes Josh.
Yes. Josh and Mandy were clearly going to have an on again, off again. They're going to get back together. At least when the pilot was written, and you're absolutely right, that's out the window practically by episode three.
It's crazy.
Sooner, and maybe you can chalk that up in terms of Maura Kelly to lack of chemistry with which they have none. I mean, that's they have none. Like whenever they talk about how they were dating, I'm like, I don't believe you ever had sex.
Ever
you two. Like I don't believe you ever dated.
Yeah,
and you're absolutely right. It's lightning in a bottle. Mm-hmm. The stuff that dreams are made of for a producer. Chemistry with him and Janelle.
You know,
Maloney,
it's interesting because I actually think that Mandy and Josh feel more like brother and sister than they do ex-lovers.
Yeah, yes.
And in a weird way, had Mandy actually been his sister,
sure, that'd
like,
be fun.
Literally, I think that would have been fun and given them something.
Yeah.
That because she really they really don't know what to do with her, and they
well, she also she had such an undefined role. It was like I forget what it is at the end of the pilot. Like you're going to be a public
consultant.
Yeah, it's just you know, because she's in meetings she wouldn't be in.
Correct.
You know, they give her a line in a meeting that really wouldn't be her line because she's a series regular. You know, so it's too
and
bad.
And then they get like, Joey Lucas to do essentially what they need Mandy to do
when
which
she
is
needs
polling
to do it.
And when she needs to. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. And. It's, but I and that, of course, the term, which I'm sure you've talked about on the show already, but the whole Mandyville thing where she's there at the event when the president and all her friends are shot. And she is not visiting them at the hospital or anything in season.
It's
she's
nuts.
Like, bye, y'all.
They don't even give her a line.
Nothing.
They don't even acknowledge nothing. That she's gone.
They don't say, oh, you know, when Mandy was. No, it's like she was a ghost. It was like she was dead the whole time and no one really saw her.
It's nuts.
Anyway.
Because you have to imagine, I mean, you obviously know this better than anybody. There's a conversation. Some studio or network executive raises their hand and says, so Mandy,
yeah, this isn't working.
Do we say anything about her disappearance?
Yeah,
and just like and it's like she never existed.
Someone had to have raised. Someone had to have raised the question. But you know, they also the ended season one with the assassination attempt.
Yeah,
if it wasn't ending with a cliffhanger, it'd be very easy. It'd just be like, oh well, she obviously moved on.
Right.
But they pick up seconds after
at
an event that she is at.
It's nuts. Although you do get the impression that my assumption anyway is that she was never coming back for season two, because when they do check in on everybody during the assassination attempt, because they do get a shot of every. You know, every one of our heroes.
Oh, no. I think they'd already decided.
They don't even show her then, I don't.
Oh, no. She was already long gone. She was already at that point averaging, a half a scene an episode.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like the back half of season one, she's barely there. They clearly made the decision, which must be horrible for her if you're coming into
not
work
great.
Every day. The show's a hit. Everyone's gelling and you're just, every time you get a new script, it's less and less. There's all these fucking Josh and Donna scenes and you're like, wait, Donna, the secretary who is an extra? I mean, I kind of feel for her because she's great. I love her, you know. So anyway.
There's a great story that Janelle Maloney told where she said that her first line is with Leo goes up to her and says, hey, can you get Josh for me? And she turns and screams Josh's name. And Leo says, I could have done that.
Oh, nice.
And it's their first moment together.
Brilliant.
And in their first scene, John Spencer turned to her and said, you're going to be here till the curtain comes down.
Awesome.
Like he just knew how good she was from like that moment.
He's so great. I love him. Well, derailing your
yeah. So speaking of Leo, great line he has early on when they're basically trying to figure out who these four votes, these five votes are, because at first they don't really know who they are. And then Leo says, there are two things in the world you don't want people seeing how you make laws and sausages, which is something that I think about still to this day. So basically from 30,000 feet, the plot of this episode is corralling these five votes back into the bin so that they can pass this bill. A bill that they know is kind of weak sauce, that isn't really going to get much done, but will look like a victory.
Yeah. Very Clinton commentary here.
Very Clinton, yes.
Yes.
So that's sort of the bigger picture here. You've got Leo. Josh goes to Leo and says he wants to throw his weight around with one of the congressmen.
Right.
Leo gives him the okay to do so. And to your point, maybe the worst scene in the episode is when he like puts on his sunglasses and he's like, "That's what he pays me for."
It's awful, and it would not be awful if I think it was aware that he's being a prick. But I actually think they think he's cool.
Yeah.
In that moment, and it's just terrible.
It sucks. Leo's marriage is tested by this. He goes home. His wife, he has forgotten his anniversary. Mm-mm. Not a good look. And Jenny, his wife, is upset with him. And over the course of the story, basically by the end of the episode, she's leaving him.
Yes.
And it sends him to Hoynes. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to him, Hoynes senses something that's up.
Yeah. He can sense being in the presence of an addict who's about to relapse.
Right.
Which is a moving thing.
Very moving.
Yeah.
It alerts us to the fact that Hoynes is also a recovering alcoholic. Mm-hmm. He has an AA meeting, and the episode ends with Leo going to that meeting.
With that gorgeous shot of the coffee pot, which is just this lovely vision, because that's sort of a visual touchstone of the AA meeting, you know? That's lovely direction. I think it's funny. the original, excuse me. Mm-hmm. The original idea for this show, as you all know, and I'm sure you've talked about in your early episodes about this, is that it was going to be a show about the president's staff doing the nuts and bolts of the White House. And the president would come in every two or three episodes for a scene or two. But it was really going to be about the workings of the staff. They realized very quickly, A, Martin Sheen's too amazing to not be a series regular, and B, you can be as cute as you want. You're not going to be able to do a show at the White House and have the president not be at least one of the ensemble. And certainly, even by mid-season one, he's the lead. What's fascinating about this episode is an example of what they thought the show was going to be the whole time, and it couldn't be. You would not have been able to sustain a television show, particularly a proper 22 episode a season show, with this kind of construction. But it's fun to watch it in this one because that's absolutely what this is. They even say, like, let's not involve the president here. This is us. Mm-hmm. And so you see him being presidential in the first scene with his speech, and he comes in for that lovely, bizarre
medication scene.
Because Sorkin is a great writer of comedy. And what's lovely about these first seasons is they can contain a scene like that. That's just a lovely little workplace farce scene. But that's it. That's all he's got in the episode. It's otherwise the show about the staff, which is one thing I really enjoyed about it on this rewatch. The Spencer was nominated for an Emmy for this episode, deservedly.
Yep.
And it's funny. I think I liked the Jenny subplot a little better than you. I thought it was, I mean, sure, she's exists just to affect Leo, the series regular, right. But the actor, and I wish I could remember her name now. She's terrific. I mean, she's terrific. It's a rare case where a woman married to an older man in a show looks, you know, like she would be
appropriate,
like age appropriate. Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. She looks like the woman who have they introduced Mallory at this point?
Yes, Mallory's in the pilot.
Oh, that's right. So they clearly cast her to a woman that looks like at Mallory's mom.
Second episode, yeah.
You know, and they feel, you know, I gotta say, for you know, 2.5 minutes of screen time, the two of them feel like they've been married for 25 years. They have wonderful chemistry. She doesn't overplay the scene or.
I didn't hate the performances I didn't hate the storyline by and large.
No, I don't even hate it. I think the reason that it
stands out is because this show is obviously a show specifically about politics, right? So when they do get into the personal lives of these people, they do stand out.
And they do rarely do that. That's true. Correct. I mean, you got Toby's ex-wife, but she's a congresswoman and kind of is more drawn into the stories, the main storyline. So that's a good point. You very rarely gotta get in the show a what happens when they go home.
Season four, CJ goes home and we had that one episode. Do you remember that?
Which I've blocked
out. I've only seen the first.
Yeah, it's funny. I religiously watched one and two. I've rewatched seasons one and two mm-hmm. many times. Mm-hmm. And parts of season three, I think I've only seen season four the first time.
Season four is the season when it's clear yeah. that Sorkin's leaving and, yeah. and things are changing. And
Rob Lowe leaves in that season.
Correct.
Right.
And yeah. Josh Molina comes in.
Right.
But it's a very rare standalone episode that has nothing to do with The West Wing, where CJ goes home and hooks up with Matthew Modine and her dad.
That's very John Wells. Peter Benton goes to the small southern town.
Very.
Finds out something about himself.
Correct.
Very.
And it almost happens around. This is a classic John Wells thing of big episode, big character leaves Rob yeah. Lowe. Next episode.
Palate cleanser. We're not going to put you right back into the show you love without Correct. One of your characters. Correct. We're going to send them to. Mm-hmm. That's total John Wells yeah. playbook. Also,
so he did that.
Also, Allison Janney, Emmy winner. Mm-hmm. Let's create yeah. a little Valentine yeah. to her.
It's a weird episode.
I'm sure it is. Really fit, I obviously have no memory of it now that you're talking about it.
But something that I do love about there's a line in the Jenny Leo stuff that I love, which is the very end. She's got her bag. She's getting in a cab, and he says, "Call me before you go to sleep."
Oh, just you know. John Spencer was such a fucking treasure. I mean, yeah. and what a wonderful last act he had with this show. Sadly, totally. Not meant to have been his last act, and yeah. His death very well integrated into the show. Actually, mm-hmm. the way they dealt with it, I thought was lovely, as I recall from the final season. But what a great actor! I mean, he was always someone before The West Wing who would pop up and shit, and you'd be like, oh, good, mm-hmm. good, this guy. You know,
he just seems so nice.
He's so nice, but then he can turn. What's so great about him and Leo is like he can be scary and mm-hmm. and tough, and then just so wonderful and paternal, and such a wonderful foil for Martin Sheen. I loved in this recent West Wing reading that they didn't even try to replicate him. They cast Sterling Brown and completely reinvented the character. It worked great. I thought it worked great. He was phenomenal. And it was an entirely different dynamic, and I just loved it. So much better than just trying to find a craggy old dude that would bring that. It was much more respectful to just entirely go a different way. But he's just terrific in this episode. Who won the Emmy this year?
It's Richard Schiff.
Oh, Richard Schiff wins. Good. Well, yeah. good.
So Richard Schiff wins for season one. Bradley Whitford wins for season two. John Spencer wins for season three.
Right, right.
But it is interesting. The John Spencer thing that you're speaking of, I completely agree with. He does something here. This is where you really start to feel like he's getting his hooks into Leo and that he fully understands the character. Hmm. It's not to say that he doesn't in the four episodes previous, but this is where, because of what we've talked about, there's some backstory being filled in.
Sure.
There's the AA component of it where he's like, oh, okay, this guy's recovering. Mm-hmm. I get this. Obviously we've had some moments with Bartlett, so we're sensing what the Leo Bartlett relationship is like. It's just all starting to fill in, and I think that John Spencer's filling in all those cracks as well with mm-hmm. with his performance. He just seems like a lovely guy. When he won his Emmy acceptance speech is so sweet, where he's like, look at all my friends, look at all my actors. They're so happy for me. Like there's just yeah. he's
well they clearly so, just, by all yeah. accounts they adored him. I mean, it was just in the way they speak of him in interviews yeah. and by all accounts adored each other, which is nice. You know, that's
yeah.
a lovely
it
thing.
Seems, yeah. It seems like they had a lot of downtime in their trailers well, waiting yeah. for scripts.
It sounds like an insane. I mean, that was the thing about, you know, yeah. about Game of Thrones is we did UK hours. Like
right.
that crew was done at 6 p.m. Or I shouldn't say that. Like it was we had 10 right. hour shoot
sure.
days.
Sure.
No yeah. lunch. We worked through lunch.
And then it was
and
over.
So the we didn't have, done. Yeah, like we yeah. I feel like the West Wing.
But you also, your show was so, first of all, location heavy, which
oh,
is
sure. yeah, of course.
Very, yeah. I'm not telling you anything did, you don't know, but for our listeners.
We did our share of exhausting night shoots, don't get me wrong. Our crew, our crew was the hardest
for our listeners,
but
for what it's worth, for people that don't know about production differences, right? I mean, The West Wing was a show that takes place almost entirely indoors, right? You had the occasional exteriors. They would fly to DC, which is also a rarity now, but most of the show is indoors. Yeah. And when you're indoors, it's easier to shoot forever.
Yeah.
It's you know, it's easier to scrap a scene and write a new scene or whatever the case might be because it's all standing sets.
Yeah.
Your show, not so much. Your show was most, I mean, good chunk of it outside on location, which is much harder to shoot. You're at the will of nature,
the elements,
and various things.
Yeah.
So it's just very interesting to sort of think about how just production differences, right? Mm-hmm. Like Aaron Sorkin could never write your show. He could never write your show because of the fact that he'd be forced into sticking with things.
Our show had to be, it was, I mean, look, we're doing it again in Game of Thrones, but it was shot. It was
just different.
It was more like a movie in as much as, you know, you knew you had to have this location this month and da 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 da. It was just, we also didn't shoot, we shot everything out of order, like one 10-hour movie as opposed to episode by episode.
Because of location work, right? Like you would shoot certain storylines.
Yeah, location work and actor availability and all of it. But, you know, I will say, I made a little crack there about the work hours, but I'll get on a little soapbox here before we move on back to The West Wing. Please. But I think our show proved that you don't have to, you know, destroy yourselves and work till 3 a.m. overtime to make a, you know, make it look good. You can go home and have dinner. That's my rant.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think it's an important thing. And I'm sure you feel the same way about your writers' rooms as well, which is that I don't think you're going to get, you know, the idea that you're going to get anything better at 11 p.m. that you would have got at 6 p.m. is a fallacy.
Yeah. I think more people are getting there now, especially this last year where people are like, you know, we can just be home. Certainly with meetings. Let's just do these meetings on Zoom. Anyway,
I want to just talk very quickly about the Toby storyline, which is kind of just a bit of lightheartedness, which is he basically gets his stocks do really well, and he's mocked for it.
Yeah, there's a great moment. The C comic relief subplot.
Right.
He's great.
He's great. CJ coming into his office asking for $125,000 is amazing because Allison Janney's laugh is the most beautiful thing in the world.
She's luminous. So she's not. She doesn't have a lot in this one, but she's just, you know.
She doesn't. It's interesting. She doesn't have a lot early in the season. We're in episode 5 now, and I'm surprised by how little she actually has.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know that Sorkin knew what CJ was yet. I don't think that he had fully sort of formed. I don't know that all of it has sort of really come into focus for him. But obviously she's a much bigger part in season 2. She becomes a bigger part near the end of season 1. But it is very interesting to your point that Allison Janney, when she's there, she's making an impact.
Oh, you can't imagine take your eyes off of her.
He's like, yeah.
Yeah. And Toby, you know, Toby's my favorite character. I mean, Richard Schiff, I think it's one of the great filmed performances. What I love about him is there's something in lesser Sorkin efforts. Actors are trying to Sorkinize their acting. Yes. They're trying to act Sorkin-y.
Correct.
And some of the actors on The West Wing do it a little bit, not too much. He doesn't do it at all. I mean, he throws everything away and still maintains the wonderful, you know, rhythm of it all and his perp, but he's just so that kind of hand dog muttery, deadpan, but
scratching his
fully
head.
But fully emotional. It's like emotional deadpan. And he's my favorite character, which is again why I despise how he was treated in the final seasons of the show. But even just with a rare Toby comic relief subplot, he didn't usually get those, but it's this one was fun. It's funny the thing
you
about
know
the
who
financial disclosures, especially now.
Yeah,
that boy did that date this episode. Jesus,
do you know who almost got the role of Toby Ziegler?
Yeah, it was Eugene Levy,
which is insane. That's a crazy thing to think about. He would have been great, just totally different.
He would have been great. I think there would have been who knows? I feel like there might have been a tendency to write him funnier with Eugene Levy doing it. But you know, Eugene Levy, there were moments in Schitt's Creek. Where like the episode where he tells his former friends off at dinner where you're like, oh no, I see your Toby there. Okay.
Yeah.
You could have.
No, I think he could have done it.
Yeah,
I think he could have done it. I think it would have been, how can I put this? Just more overtly Jewish, I guess, is kind of what I'm getting at. Like, sure. I don't think that.
Yeah.
Richard Schiff is phenomenal, and Toby Ziegler is one of my favorite sort of overtly Jewish characters in television. Mm. And yet, at the same time, it doesn't. I don't know. There's something about Eugene Levy's sort of Borscht Belt doing things that I think it would have played.
I think you know, from him, there's no one I don't hate right now. Is just, there's no one I don't hate right now. You know, it's just more of a
ba-bum, stickier, yeah,
which is fine, and you know, would have played. But it would have been different. And what you know, Shlomi and Wells and Sorkin, I mean, the way they, God, the alchemy of this cast.
Yeah. To underline what you were saying earlier, I don't think the Toby Bartlett relationship has the same gravity.
No,
with Eugene Levy.
No.
That it does with Richard Schiff.
No, and they would have never. It probably would have never happened because he was writing for his actors. He was channeling what his actors were giving him and creating story.
Totally,
which is again generally how TV works until our show came along and just
blew it all up,
fucked the whole art form. you know. I'm kidding, of course, a little, but you know, you can, that's what you did. Like you were like, ER is another example of that. You know,
To wrap this up, at the end of every episode of these West Wing episodes, I've been asking the favorite episode of yours, of the West Wing. Do you have a favorite? Do you have one that you come back to? Do you, is there a couple that come to mind?
Well, my favorite was the one I originally asked to do and told me. You haven't announced who's doing it, so I won't spoil it. But my favorite is In Excelsis Deo, which is Richard Schiff's Emmy Award winning episode.
It is
from this season.
It's a beautiful episode.
Which episode is that? Is it 9, 10?
It's 10. It's the last episode.
Directed by my friend Alex Graves, who directed my favorite of my scripts, or one of my favorites of my scripts on the show, on Thrones. And I had a great time just pumping him for West Wing stories the whole, you know. And Alex stayed with it the whole time. You know, he directed that live debate episode.
He also directed The Fringe pilot, which is one of my favorite pilots.
It's a great
looking pilot.
He's great. He directed, I think, some of the best episodes of Game of Thrones and really nice guy. But In Excelsis Deo, that wonderful, the main subplot, of course, being that Toby, by happenstance, encounters a veteran, a homeless veteran who passes. He dies and he was wearing Toby's coat because he donated a coat to the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
And he just, the injustice of a veteran that won't get a military funeral, you're going to have an episode about it, but I love it. Let's talk about it now for an hour. It's my favorite, tied probably with a close tie with, I just, In the Shadow of Two Gunmen, the two-parter.
So good.
It's just such a, what's fun about it when you're watching it is it's so great. Like the first season was a hit and they have given them the keys to the candy store. Mm-hmm. And it's like, here you go. Flashbacks, action sequence.
Can I just say that I love, whenever you, any sort of, this is how the team came together. It's just always great.
It's so satisfying. I don't really buy CJ's origin story. Yeah. That's my only flaw with it.
Yeah.
Really? You were working entertainment PR? And
I didn't really buy it either. It does give Sorkin the chance to make fun of Hollywood.
That's the thing. But other than that, I think it's kind of perfect. And and again, Richard Schiff, the best reaction to someone being injured ever filmed is when Richard Schiff sees Josh get shot and bleeding out. It is the most real.
It's unreal.
Every time I think that Brad Whitford has been shot, that they shot.
It's unbelievable.
You know, he's such a grounded. And apparently this is, I guess, by his own admission, what made him kind of a nightmare to work with, and might be a reason he was phased out. is that he was just he was one of those actors. Stephen Delane was like this on Thrones, where it's like, why am I saying that? He can't say it unless he can
make unless he believes it. Yeah.
And believe it. And what was great about that was it challenged. I mean, Stephen would come up to me and be like, Stephen was also like, what the hell is this? In general with Game of Thrones, but you know, he was that kind of actor where he was like, no, you wrote this and I think you probably felt really clever, but I have to say it and I don't think this makes sense. And you go, you know, there is a way to make this better. And I think Schiff, by most accounts, it was that sort of actor.
Yes.
And I think Sorkin could roll with that. And from what I gather, the powers that be after have, were less inclined to.
I went to the West Wing Weekly's final live.
Oh, did you episode, go? Oh,
which was tremendous.
Awesome.
And there's a moment in it where I think it was Brad Whitford talking about how whenever a new director would come in, someone who hadn't directed an episode before, and would try to block Richard, he'd just laugh at them.
It's like, yeah. I'm going to do what I do. Get the camera ready. Yeah, and that's got to be really hard, especially with those kind of, you know, well-oiled machine shows, somebody coming in
it's amazing.
It's amazing.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you.
About
thank you.
Five Votes Down.
Total pleasure.
I hope that you'll come back with Kenny so the two of you can debate, I assume, something together.
Yeah. No, Kenny.
It'll be good.
Kenny knows my address.
I know that Kenny's desperate to do a Departed episode with you and Liz Hannah. He wants to fight about that with you guys.
But wait a minute, Departed's not from 1999.
That's
just going to be a bonus.
It's going to be a bonus. Liz and I
are Twitter buddies, and I have a total brain crush on her. So
she's the best.
I would love to meet her and defend the Departed.
She's coming on for Mr. Willis of Ohio. So
nice. She's terrific. I'm very pleased she talks to me on Twitter. That's funny. The Departed.
Kenny just like really wants to fight. He just likes fighting. So you know.
No. I'll defend the Departed. I got a great defense of the Departed. Ready to go.
Great. Can't wait. One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hannah, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. It's 1999, podcast like it. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here.
I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.